Hey everybody, and welcome to Take a Deep Breath. I'm your breathwork coach and host, Mike, and it's my job on this breathcast to bring you interesting guests and start to pick apart their methods, techniques, tips and tricks and give you something actionable which you can take away. And today I will not disappoint with that. We are talking about inspiratory muscle training. That is a mouthful. What is that? Well, that is to use really your diaphragm properly, this wonderful muscle that goes all the way around your back. And sadly, so many of us are not using it properly. Did you know, for example, that when your diaphragm, you're not really thinking about it, it moves about 1 centimeter. And if you consciously think about your diaphragm, i.e. doing some breathing exercises, you can get 10 centimetres of movement out of there, which is bonkers. So today's guest is Sean Coakley. Sean has got such a wide variety of background. He has been obsessed with breathing for such a long period of time, and he's been working at a company called AeroFit. He works with a number of different breathing companies. And the best way I can really describe this little device is it's got a Bluetooth connection and a really cool app, and you can set how hard you want the inhale and exhale to be. And don't worry, because I know we've talked many times about the dangers of mouth breathing, nose versus mouth, and I'm going to do a video about that separately soon. But this exercise, really using this, is how you can make your abdominal muscles, that's a mouthful, isn't it, your diaphragm stronger and become fitter. Sean's done work recently with Chelsea football team, which I think is pretty cool. And he's got a background in yoga. He's got a really interesting backstory as well. So you're going to want to get yourself a cup of tea. You're going to want to get comfortable, and you're going to want to learn now about inspiratory muscle training. So without further ado, let's get stuck into the podcast with Sean. Cheers. Good. Well, Sean, thank you first of all so much for being here, my friend. How are you doing today?
I'm doing lovely. It's actually, for me, opposite of you, it's a dark and rainy day in Florida, which we don't get very often. So it's actually quite nice for me to experience this over here. You might be used to that.
I sadly am used to that. And I've got a bit of Italian heritage. So I always blame that for the fact that I don't like the English weather, because I feel like half of my genetics are saying you should be in a nice sunny southern climate. So
maybe you should follow that lead one day.
I think, yeah, there was a chap actually I had on the podcast. He was a red light therapy producer. Mm-hmm. And he said a term that's always stuck with me, which is, he said, I've moved to the southern hemisphere for my health. And I've heard people say, I've gone vegan, I've gone dairy free, blah, 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 blah. You know, I'd never heard that term before. So I found that quite interesting. That's always stuck with me there, but we'll see what happens.
Right. Go find your blue zone, right?
That's it. Yeah.
Your optimal state of living. Absolutely.
I'm sorry to go on a tangent here. I found out, do you know why they call them blue zones?
No, I don't.
So the guy, I think he might be British, actually. He had only had a blue Sharpie pen, and he was circling on the map these areas of longevity. And that's where that term. See, yeah, I always think, where's this magical blue zone comes from? But there you go. It's got a less magical term to it, or history. Anyway, we'll get stuck into it. So thank you so much for being here. I'm really excited today to have a conversation with you, because you know, I've done 35, 40 breathcasts now, and people start to think, oh, how can you talk about breathing for so many hours? And I think we haven't even scratched the surface. And one particular term we just spoke about a minute ago was respiratory muscular training, which is a very new term to me that you've just mentioned before we hit record. So I'm so excited to get into the weeds with that for you today. But would you mind, just for our guests, just give us, I'd love to know a bit about your backstory. I know we've spoke a bit off camera, but if you wouldn't mind sharing with my audience a bit about kind of who you are and what some of your training's like.
Sure. And thanks, Mike. And thanks for having me, by the way. I've been looking forward to this. This is exciting. And your YouTube channel, and I've watched all of your other interviews, by the way. I've learned things from them. So thank you for providing your service. It's great that you're sharing and educating people around the world, because I like to think I'm trying to do the same thing. So we're brother in arms in a lot of ways. So it's very cool. So for all the people who don't know me, my name's Sean Coakley. I'm a performance breath coach. That's what I call myself. I'm currently the master instructor at AeroFit. My backstory is a bit unique. As a young kid, I was a very competitive athlete. I played football or soccer, as they know it here in the States. And I made it all the way up to Division I university level, where I got a full scholarship to go play at that level. And I had aspirations of becoming a professional footy one day, but life happens and things change. So I broke my ankle in my junior year at university and had nowhere to go, became very depressed and was deciding what my future might be. I wasn't quite interested in school at the time, although I had inklings of academic desires. I just hadn't expressed them yet. So I got on a bike. I got on a bicycle basically because I was in great shape from playing footy all my whole life. And I raced and I started winning races. And so I go, so God had a plan. He took me off the pitch and he put me on a bike. And so I started racing. And long story short, I had a really bad accident. I broke a lot of bones, fractured my cervical spine, my lumbar spine, my ribs, and just had a really difficult experience. And in the midst of all this, I was preparing to try to go to med school. I was looking at advanced things to do in my life, and all of it got stripped away in one afternoon in my mind and in my body. And I got depressed. I felt ill mentally. I was not sharp anymore. I didn't know why I was here anymore. And out of nowhere, the universe threw me hot yoga back before it became popular. And I took all of my passion, all of my vigor, if you will, that I had for sports, and I funneled it into learning about how my mind and body work together. And it's 35 years later, basically. And I've been studying breath and breath performance and respiratory science as a medical doctor would study academically. So I've been at it for, I've been reading books, I'd never stop. And so I have a love and passion for it because connecting with my mind and opening up those wounds, those traumatic psychosomatic wounds through breath work, led me back to life, got me back to standing on my feet and made me happy again. And so I love nothing more than every day. Now it's respiratory muscular training I talk about because of my day job, but I teach people about breathing 24 hours a day. It's what I love. It's what I do. I'll never stop doing it. And it's going to be hard for you to stop me from talking about it. I get really excited about it.
This could be the first 9-hour podcast we do about breathing.
It's possible.
So was the hot yoga the gateway drug into the breath world for you then? Was that the first?
Yeah. And I'll tell you why, because the injuries that I sustained and the recommendations or diagnostics that I got from the doctors that were looking at me back then was to don't move, take painkillers, and which is a negative compounding effect, right? Mm. You got to keep moving. You got to keep active. All the soft tissue that was damaged from those accidents, I had no way of opening it back up. And so for me, I don't recommend anything to anybody, but for me, hot yoga worked because the heat allowed that fascia to open up. It allowed the movement to happen again and blood to start to flow into those areas, which expedited the healing process. And it was traumatic. I cried. I was scared. Emotions came up. You know, hot yoga has a way of really getting to your core because it's hard and it pushes you to your limits. And I like that because I was a competitive athlete. So my personality matched it, and the healing component of opening up with the heat really brought me back to life. And then after hot yoga opened me up, I studied every form of yoga possible. I just went down the rabbit holes, which I tend to do because I wanted to know everything about everything. And that's my personality. So I like to consume information all the time.
I think Joe Rogan says that, I know he does hot yoga, but he says something like yoga is like doing jujitsu with yourself, which I quite like.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Brilliant battle.
Yeah. I've never done hot yoga, but I've played around with different yogas, never massively, but I was in Bali for about a month and I went every day there. There was no air conditioning. It was very humid. So it wouldn't have been as hot as what you're doing, but it was, you know, we were warm while we were doing it. So interesting. I'm going to bounce around a little bit here, but just something that's come to mind. So I had, I think I cracked a rib a couple of years ago, playing about doing jiu-jitsu actually. And I'm a big fan of the sauna. So I'm in the sauna. I tried to get in sauna at least 4 times a week. If I could go every day, I'd go every single day. So that sauna experience, I've probably been using the sauna at that average level, apart from COVID, for about 3 or 4 years, just addicted to it. Something about the heat that pulls me in. And sure. I'm going somewhere with this. I had my first fascia related massage last week. And it was wonderful. She did some stuff on my jaw, the calf. You know, I've got a bad back, so she's working on my calves. And she's like, I normally have to explain to people, I have to work on the calves to heal the back. And people are like, what the hell? But what she said was, my ribs here do not move. but here they do. And I was, and she goes, that's a problem because you're not able to take a proper breath if your ribs are stuck here. So, and then it got me thinking, could it be something to do with the cracked ribs years ago? But I don't know if you've got any insight into maybe how I can get these ribs to start being a bit more wiggly again.
I think we will work our way into that in this conversation because I think respiratory Excellent. Muscular training has a fascinating Okay. way of waking those muscles up. But and again, I don't want to go down the rabbit hole for too long or too deep here, but I personally believe that as human beings, we compartmentalize and psychosomatically isolate injury in a unique way. And breathing has the ability to wake up certain areas that have been dormant or we protect naturally, even though it might be unconsciously. Mm. So my injuries that I had to faithfully wake back up, and in my world, pain in is like pain out. So when you release the pains, whether they're emotional, physical, whatever they are from your body, the energy is, it's energy at the end of the day. So the energy it takes to injure is equal to the energy it takes to heal, the outbound release of that energy. And there's a bravery or a courage or an awareness, I think, that you have to enter into that area of injury again and be willing to undo the pain, which is painful in its own right. So through breath coaching over the years, I've found it always gets to psychosomatic. It always leads to psychological. It always allows to regress emotions that are trapped in the fascia of the body that unconsciously hold you from moving or waking up a place in the body. And that's why breath work and respiratory muscular training is interesting in that regard, because it literally isolatory way forces the muscles of inspiration and expiration to work. So if there's a weakness or a spot that has been ignored for a while, you feel that pretty quickly and you start to become aware of that weakness. And of course, as you know, awareness is the step towards healing and towards opening up. So if RMT or a device like an arm, you know, an AeroFit type device or something could help wake those areas up, because it forces you to visualize or sense that weak area that you've been ignoring or protecting, maybe it's the first step in the process of healing. So I have a feeling that this might help you a bit down the road.
Okay, that's exciting. Yeah, because it was brand new information, because I just assumed that all my ribs were moving, but clearly some aren't. Okay, so let's dig a bit into that then. So I'm just conscious there's some people like us that, you know, have thought, and obviously you're much further down the road than I am, but I've got a good understanding of breathing, and some people that might be just coming to this the first time. So would you mind just giving us an explanation maybe for some of the key players in the muscle game when it comes to breathing and what some of those things are?
Yeah, happy to do it. And it's actually pretty rudimentary at the end of the day. And so anybody who's listening, don't be scared. I'm not going to go too deep, and it's not too complicated actually at the end of the day. I teach children all the time and they're fun and they get it just like that. So at the core of the muscularity of inspiration and expiration, there's a couple groups of muscles. There's the primary muscle, which is the diaphragm, or should be, I should say, the diaphragm. It should be the primary muscle of breathing. And the diaphragm is a dome-shaped muscle that if I tilt my camera down here a little bit, it's a dome shape in the sense that it comes up and it permeates the entire 360-degree area of your body. So it's not just a frontal plane. So the term belly breathing, for example, to me is a really nasty term because it forces people to think the only direction you breathe in is forward, which is, it should be, that's a falsehood. So the diaphragm circumnavigates the body. It's an ovular shaped muscle and it goes all the way around to the backside where the spine is. So you have the capacity to breathe in all directions in that downward ability. Above the diaphragm, you start to get into the intercostal muscles, and there's inter and external intercostal muscles. So the external ones pull yourself open. They create the vacuum effect, if you will, by drawing breath in like a vacuum, physical vacuum would. And in the opposite direction, the compression of the rib cage squeezes the lung tissue to push the breath out. And it's primarily the intercostal muscles. Because remember, the diaphragm, it's a muscle that when it contracts, it pulls breath in. When it relaxes, it allows breath to come back out. So those work in concert. And then as you get up to the upper region, the area that is sometimes equated with stress or the wrong style of breathing sometimes, depending on the school of breathing, you have your ancillary muscles, like your scalene muscles in your throat and your clavicular musculature, which are minute muscles. I won't get into naming those all because that gets a little bit too deep in the weeds. And then muscles like your sternocleidomastoid, this larger muscle up here. And these ancillary muscles have the capacity to elevate your rib cage or your shoulder girdle. So if you're filling up percentage of a cup, and the last 10% or 15% is up here. That's done by lifting and opening. So it's the one area of the lungs where a lift helps permeate and fill that last accessible point of lung tissue that we're suggested to typically not use unless we're under stress or fight or flight, and we need that to ramp up. And there are schools of breathing like Tummo breathing or Wim Hof breathing, where you access all those muscles because you want to create a kind of an outcome effect. But so that's the basics. And I don't want to negate the reverse side of the body. So there are subscapular muscles, the muscles that are between your shoulder blade and your rib cage that you need to work to become more flexible. Because again, I could breathe backwards just as well as I could breathe forwards into my body. So you never want to negate a 360 degree view of how the muscles can draw open this cage, appropriately called a cage, because the lung tissue could expand quite dramatically if this cage wasn't in the way. So we want that benefit of flexibility and strength to open all the way around our body so we could take calm full breaths, not hyper full breaths, or not struggle to take those breaths, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. Yeah. And it's funny, I never really think about breathing in the back. Even though I heard that, I think they learned with COVID patients not to stick them on the back anymore because they weren't being able to breathe properly. But yeah, I never think of the diaphragm back here or the lungs at the back. So that's really interesting. So there's muscles there we need to work on as well.
Absolutely. And for people with back pain, backside breathing, and I in my school of breathing, my own personal coaching that I do, I have this 8-directional breath that I teach people, and it's just a way of accessing the different, I call it independent suspension kind of for your breathing. You want to articulate breath into whatever area you want to be able to direct it. For someone who's a back pain recovery guy, it's in my past now, lying on my bed and being able to breathe so relaxed into the backside of my spine to stimulate those erector muscles around my lower back and let my hips relax, that allows me to release some of that pain, that inflammation pain, or that tension that I was creating to protect that area. So it does become really important for people with back pain to learn how to breathe into those areas, not avoid those areas. It helps the healing process.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. And people, I keep hearing the word pelvic floor mentioned a lot when it comes to breathing. Mm-hmm. So what's going on with that bit in relation to the diaphragm?
It's an interesting topic, and we could spend a lot of time on it and maybe never come to any conclusion. So I won't spend too much time on it. Sure. And I think typically it's talked about when women are breathing, right? Because the pelvic floor, typically when you talk about birth or you talk about other ways of affecting it, and here's how I'll answer it and tell me if you want me to go in a different direction. And I'm going to utilize the term belly breathing to get back there, right? So the pelvic floor, when you breathe in full breaths and you are able to articulate your diaphragm in that downward motion to compress the abdominal organs, if you will, this is why we learn to relax the belly muscles, not distend the belly muscles to go down. I do not like to discuss with people the ability to breathe below the navel, and there's a reason for it. So I avoid the pelvic floor a little bit, and I'll tell you why. The old yogic style of breathing, and I studied yoga for a long time. If you see the old yogis with the really distended bellies, and we all love the pictures of Buddha for serenity and visualization in our mind. Well, in fact, if you habitually breathe and try to open up your belly below the navel, over time that becomes a pattern and a habit, and it distends the abdominal organs in a way that they're not designed to distend. So I, particularly in my world, I like to keep people's awareness of the diaphragm above the navel line and not distend the belly below that area, and strengthen the muscles of inspiration rather than distend the muscles that go down towards the pelvic floor. So you maintain that original compact pressure of below the navel area, so between your hips and your navel, because over time, if you did it for 25, 30 years as a pattern, you're going to rearrange the abdominal organs in such a way that they really aren't meant to operate that way. There is a reason, an anatomical reason, why you want to have some tension below the navel line. So I know I didn't directly answer your question, but that's the direction I like to talk about, because belly breathing and distending are stuff that people should not do generically when they breathe. And I think the term belly breathing should be eradicated from the vocabulary of breathers. It gives people the wrong notion of what breathing for health or benefit really is. Yeah. So I know that's not a direct answer, but that's my
answer. No, that's good. I hadn't really considered that. So Have you come across some evidence there, or have you seen that with patients where they've got problems because they've been doing, or is it with the old yogis you've come across something there?
Well, sure. I mean, so especially with sedentary people who don't exercise at all. And so elderly, you know, who have very weak abdominal muscles because they're not standing or moving around. So the muscles of erection don't work. The back muscles and the stomach muscles, those core muscles, once those start to distend and become weak, there's a myriad of problems that come about. The ability to defecate, the ability to go to the bathroom properly, all these things. And we won't get into the weeds about that. But there's a lot of digestive issues. There's a lot of functional issues, I'll say, that come up if over time, those core muscles of engagement that hold us together as human beings to move as we were designed to do, if those are not functioning the proper way, you start to lose capabilities. Mm. That should be a whole other conversation.
That's part two. Okay. No, that's very interesting. Thank you. I took you off topic there a little bit, but I'm very curious about that. I've not really heard too much in that area. So let's jump into this, RMT then, respiratory muscle training. So today was the first time I've really heard that explained to me before we hit record. So can you just give us an overview of what that actually means?
Sure. At its core level, the simplistic definition, RMT, sometimes it's called IMT because the academic study for a long time was focused around the inspiratory muscular training. So you'll hear those two terms used together if you study this. But the generic umbrella is respiratory muscular training, or RMT. Mm-hmm. At its core, it's really providing resistance when you breathe. So making it more difficult, or if you will, like adding weights to when you curl your bicep, same concept, we're providing resistance through a widget, if you will, so we can make it more difficult, more resistant for you to draw breath in as well to push breath out of the body. So you're focusing on isolating the muscles of inspiration and expiration and forcing them to work and to build hypertrophy, not atrophy. So you're building the strength of those muscles. Mm. And you're also allowing those muscles over time to become more tone, less resistant to lactic acid buildup like any other muscle group. So you're becoming more efficient, flexible, and strong in the ability to exchange air in and out of the body. And that's difficult to do with endurance workouts or high intensity workouts because those don't isolate the muscles of breathing. And when you're moving around, you're putting tension around the muscles of breathing, which restrict breath in general. So with RMT, one of the facets of RMT is that you do it in isolation, meaning you do RMT when you're sitting or lying down. You don't do it while you're riding a bike or while you're running, because that's counterintuitive in this little world. When you do RMT, you want those muscles accessible all ways around the body. So you don't want to be putting abdominal tension or erector tension of the back and stomach muscles to draw the rib cage in. You want full balloon capacity and you want as much space. And again, back to that 360 diameter of breathing, you don't want to impede the work that you're doing while you're building muscle, because you're also building a habit at the same time. So there's that dualistic notion of building muscle strength and flexibility strength, but also building habit at the same time. And that's what RMT really is. The foundation of RMT is, if you will.
Mm. And so just that gadget. So I've got one of those. I've played about with the AeroFit a little bit, but not too much. So can you just tell people, so what's going on there? So you can, I know you can adjust the inhale resistance and the exhale resistance, can't you, on those?
Correct. Yeah. And it's, you know, for me, I'm probably older than you, Mike, so I'll date myself for a moment. A long time ago when I was a kid, and there was an old James Bond movie and he was underwater and he put a device that would look similar. Mm. So it looks like a scuba mouthpiece kind of thing. When you put it in your mouth, easy to hold. This is a very soft silicone based mouthpiece. So you just put it in your mouth, and you're absolutely correct on the dials on this AeroFit. You can see, I'll hold it up here. There's numbers and letters. And on one side, you'll see the word in, the other side, you see the word out. So inspiratory, expiratory, if you will. And you're able to dial these. And inside of the device, there's no really moving parts, if you will. There's extruded drill holes, I'll call them, inside. So when you go from 1 to 6, 1 is easy, 6 is hardest. A is easiest, F is hardest. The app that's attached to this device or on your phone tells you what resistance levels, what time settings. And in the app are expressive breathing patterns that you are aware of, like apnea, hypoxia, hyperventilation. Mm. We guide you through all those with this, as you see a little red ball of light go across your phone and you're trying to track those patterns. And so we tell you what resistance and how long, and the experts of the world who I have the pleasure of working with have dumped their intelligence into the app. So it takes the guessing game out of ratios and styles of breathing. So you literally just follow the ball, turn your mind off, meditate and exercise. And we lead you down the path of whatever kind of school of breathing you assign yourself to. So it's really cool in that regard.
Yeah. So I've never really considered this, but I know the diaphragm is a muscle, but what your expertise in is a bit like doing weightlifting, but with the diaphragm, would that be a fair comparison?
It's absolutely fair way to say it. No, it's not crude at all. In fact, it's a great way to explain it. So I used to say it's a treadmill for your diaphragm. Mm. That's how I used to say it. But I like that, I think your analogy is perfect, because the best way to think about it is if you're breathing without resistance all day long, it's like a bodybuilder going into a gym and just pumping his arms like this, right? This is not going to build muscle, right? Your body's used to this work. So if I want to increase the musculature and the flexibility of the muscles of inspiration and expiration, I need to provide resistance to those muscles. And muscles love resistance because it helps stretch the fibers, and I'll use the term rip the fibers a little bit. And that's when the chemistry happens, where the muscle fibers start to strengthen and lengthen. And that's where you get more efficiency. And at the end of the day, breathing is about efficiency. And I would say human anatomy and physiology is about efficiency. We'll go there later. Mm-hmm. So if we can make these muscles more efficient, stronger and more flexible, it takes the stress of breathing well away. Mm-hmm. It makes the effort to breathe easier in general, which has a myriad of benefits. And we can talk about those down the road.
No, let's do that. I'm just always curious when it comes to things like, I don't know. I always think about like hunter-gatherer times, a fully functional human. You know, we were touching the ground with our bare feet. Now we don't do that. So we've caused problems there. You know, we would get daylight in the morning, and now we don't do that. We flood our bodies with blue light at night. You know, so we've created all these problems with tech. And then there's often solutions for that. And a lot of them tend to be tech related, but then it's obviously grounding and all that sort of jazz. But I guess I'm just curious, if you looked at kind of one of our cousins from the hunter-gatherer era, would they have had stronger muscles there, do you think? Or is this gadget solving a problem that we've always had, but it's like an improvement, a step up?
Yeah, it's a great perspective question at the end of the day. Locomotors, legs and arms, I believe may have been stronger because they were used all day long. And we weren't built into lazy humans that we are today, where everything's kind of given to us. But the function of the respiratory muscles are such where, unless you're operating with them or utilizing them in isolation, the body's not building them. So if you're a hunter-gatherer, you are lifting rocks, lifting wood, moving things around, squatting, bending, building muscle. The function of breathing itself does not build muscle. Your body just keeps kind of a homeostatic level of interaction, so you don't die, right? At the end of the day, and your sympathetic nervous system monitors the biochemical receptors in the brain to know if you're exchanging CO2 out of the body and O2 into the body. So it really just is, it's a primal brain, genetically imprinted, voluntary, but slightly involuntary at the same time mechanism. And it's unique in the sense like our heart rate, where it happens all day, whether we like it or not, but you have the conscious ability to control it if we choose to. But back to your muscular question, what this helps with is improve the muscles that you don't have any other way of working out. Mm-hmm. And it's not the same as aerobic efficiency or VO2 max and other things that we could talk about as well. So those aerobic efficiencies have nothing really to do in a lot of ways with muscular development in the respiratory system.
Okay, that's interesting. So just this, the resistance is benefiting us because it's putting our diet. Is it doing something for the ribs as well? Is it doing something to the intercostals?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, so back to the original musculature, the diaphragm, the intercostals, and the ancillary muscles, of course. And so if you have tension in your rib cage, or like me, if you have a thorax region injury, right? You protect it, you don't move it, you stop using that area for a while because you're used to ignoring that and amplifying other areas to take up the lack that you have in another area. This device, when you work this device, and I work with some of the best athletes in the world, like world champions, top level people, they use this device in 5 to 6 minutes at the harder settings, the F6, the E5 settings, they're sweating, they're tired, and they feel like they've done a round of crunch sit-ups, because when you're working the diaphragm, like any other muscle group, it creates lactic acid. It gets tired. Mm-hmm. You don't train it very often. So in the beginning, when you start doing respiratory muscle training, you're going to feel a little bit of sensitivity, if you will. This should not be seen as a no pain, no gain kind of concept, but you don't train your diaphragm with resistance all the time. So it is going to be aware that you're doing exercise. You're going to all of a sudden go, why does my stomach feel sore? It's not your stomach. It's actually your diaphragm that might feel a little sore, because you're engaging it in lifting weight, if you will, or resistance.
And that's a cool. And what are some of the benefits then of doing this? If people started doing this tomorrow, what could they expect to see as a difference later on?
Yeah, sure. Here, this is where it's kind of cool, because unlike yoga, which could take a lifetime or years to, you know, change the body and, you know, and adapt and so forth. And God, forgive me for saying that, because yoga people will say, that's not true. It helps you right away. So I'll take that back and I'll restructure it a little bit. Inspiratory muscular training or respiratory muscular training, after 3 to 5 days of doing this every day for 10 minutes or less a day, you're instantly going to see, and this is a generic statement, but it's generically true. People are going to see increased volume capacities, meaning as an average human being, typically as a male, you'd have around 5 to 5.5 liter capacity of exchanging breath. After a week or two of using a device like this, typically people see a 0.5 liter, 1 liter, 1.5 liter, even up to 2 liter delta increase in their capacity to exchange breath in and out of the body. So that is incredibly noticeable, because the language that people come back to me with, Mike, is they say, Sean, all of a sudden, I feel like the weight's been lifted off my chest. Mm. I could finally take that last little bit of breath that I never could quite accomplish. And so I could now relax, because the stress of pulling breath into the body has gone away or diminished. And so that's a really cool thing to hear, because whether you're a professional athlete or a 75-year-old grandmother, those improvement deltas are the same. You can go from a 1.5 liter grandmother to a 2.5 liter grandmother and overcome COPD impediments and play with your grandkids again, or you can gain a marginal gain and win a gold medal instead of a bronze medal. So it universally and generically helps people, no matter where they start, to increase those volume capacities. And that alone is a tremendous factor, because it brings confidence to movement. For athletes, it brings confidence to go further and farther without feeling the stress of breathing. Because you might be aware of this from all your other conversations, Mike, but the respiratory muscles utilize about 10 to 15% of the available O2 that we take in. So if you think about that, you want those muscles to be in as good a shape as possible, because you don't want the demand of O2 from those muscles to overtake the locomotor muscles. And that, we'll talk about the metabolic reflex a little while down the road here, because there's another very unique benefit that this provides, which is to stop the vasoconstriction. When you work out a lot, your body naturally wants to pull the blood back to core to feed the heart, the lungs, and the brain. We can help RMT actually solves that problem, which is really neat, but we should talk about that in just a couple dots down the road.
Okay. So people are saying that, first of all, can you increase lung capacity, or is that a bit of a myth and it's not the lung capacity that's increasing? Yeah. Is it the drag?
Great question, right? And I love this question, because I'm particularly faced with this every single day. And I'm going to give you two versions of an answer, and you could sort them out, and I'll let your audience sort them out too. So one thing, when I speak to academics and medical doctors, they have studied linear mechanics, I like to call it that, where they believe vital lung capacity, for example, is finite. And in the academic world, that's true. They believe that there is a finite capacity to vital lung, or VLC, vital lung capacity. For all the people listening who don't know what VLC is, when you take a full breath in and you breathe that out to the fullest extent you can, they measure that exhale breath and they count the liters of air that comes out of your body down to your reserve values, which is, you never quite empty out all the air in your lungs. There's always a little bit left so that the lung tissue doesn't stick together. That's how they measure what they call your VLC, or vital lung capacity. Now, when you use a device like this, it tempts you to believe that you're increasing that capacity. What I'm going to suggest, and the term that I've come up with to bring the two sides together, is I call it accessible vital capacity now instead of vital capacity. Because if you think about a cup that's 8 ounces capable, rarely does any human being explicitly fill that 8 ounce cup up to 8.0? Mm-hmm. You and I on any given day might be able to fill our breathing cup up to 6 ounces. So in the world of academia debate, I would argue that there's still 2 ounces that you can fill up that you've never accessed because mm-hmm. your muscles are limiting you, pressures are limiting you, psychosomatic issues to take deeper breaths are limiting you. So what's that delta area that you're improving? So to satisfy the academics, I say, okay, VLC is finite. That's fine. Only if we could agree that most people don't access their full VLC.
Right.
And that's where AVLC comes into play. Yeah. So it's a little tranche that I've dug out for myself to get people to think about human potential rather than medical science, because I believe people like you and I, Mike, can improve our capacities beyond what academics like to agree on, because they're held to different standards than human potential. But that little area of delta where if you believe you're the best breather you could be and you could never become better, well, then sure, your VLC will never increase. But how do you explain the delta? That's the world I live in. So I like that space because it gives me the ability to encourage people to develop the courage to go beyond fear limitations and restrictive thought and open up. And we have been able to show, I haven't done it in an academic study, but we're working on that right now. So that'll be, you know, soon in the future, we'll be able to post something that actually has a signature on the bottom that says it was an academic study that hopefully proves this. But right now, I've seen personal testimonial, I've seen in action people increase those capacities because their muscles are overcoming the pressure, if you will, after they train to draw more breath into the body and therefore expel that breath to be measured.
Makes sense.
So, yeah. Does that make sense? I know it's a tricky debate area, right? And a lot of people get dogmatic around it. So I want to be careful. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was gonna say, in my simple brain, I feel like if the diaphragm is stronger, it can probably move a bit lower, which means you're drawing more in. And if it's stronger, you can probably squeeze out a little bit more as well. So I feel like those two things might make it. I was reading a little while ago that I think, and you'll probably know these figures better than me, I think our diaphragm on average moves around 2 centimeters when we're unconsciously breathing, but we do have the power to move up to 10 centimeters if we're consciously. And I'm assuming that a lot of us have probably got our diaphragms locked anyway, so we probably can't get that full 10 centimeters where something like that and some resistance training probably helps. Well, I'm asking you now, does that help move the diaphragm and unlock it? Is that a right term, unlocking the diaphragm? I think that's a brilliant term.
Yeah. I mean, let's use that because I think that's really a key. Everything when it comes to breath or it comes to psychosomatic issues of optimizing the body, you do have to unlock or biohack, if you will, those areas of the body to enhance them. So I think that term is brilliant and it's well applied in this conversation, Mike. So yeah, I would stick with that when it comes to explain this. So if I were to extend this conversation a bit to the world of breathing gymnastics, as one of my friends calls it, and talk about free divers, of which I know many. I train world champion free divers and I worked with a lot of people who can do superhuman things like hold their breath for 20 minutes and stuff like that. In that elite world of breath athletics, those people have defined an art form that happens to be a sport of expanding the absolute maximum capacities of breath exchange and breath awareness. So I have people in that space who have vital capacities of 9 to 10 liters of air capacity, but that's because they spend 6 hours a day stretching and training that ability to breathe. So it's back to consistency. If you want to run a faster marathon, train for marathon every day. If you want to be a breath athlete, like a free diver, if you train 5 hours a day doing that, of course your diaphragm is going to get more strength and more flexibility, and you're going to be able to pull the balloon bigger. I think a really interesting thing when I was young, and I was getting my degrees in public health and epidemiology when I was young, in the cadaver lab, there was always this thing where they take pig lungs. If you take the rib cage off a pig and you blow up those lungs, you could blow them up to a massively sized balloon. And the restriction was the cage.
Yeah.
So in my mind, that started my thought process around, wait, I could become almost infinite in my thought, if you will, around the expansion capacity. The only thing in the way is my bone structure and my lack of ability to utilize my muscles more efficiently. So
yes,
in the world of theory, I think there's more to it. than these finite concepts of academia and medical world thought processes.
Mm, that's cool. Thinking about the ribcage for a second then, I've had a couple of other people on talking about some of similar things, but not to the same level where you're at. But one person was telling me about the benefit of twisting. Mm-hmm. What else is there that we can do? So this is obviously part of it, and we've got gadgets like that, but what else can we be doing to kind of get those ribs moving and expanding the rib cage a bit? Because to your analogy, you're right. If those pig lungs are growing, you know, can go so big, but they're trapped by a cage. If that cage is rigid and tight and it's got stuck over the years, what should we be doing to get that opening up?
Yeah, I'll have to answer that in a short version because I could go on for days about the exercises you could do to increase the stretching capacity. So from the world of yoga, right? And I'll call it stretching for the moment, right? Simple stretches, like there's a posture called half moon that they do in yoga. You won't be able to see me do it, but if I put my arms up over my head and I bend to the side and stay there and I'm opening up the lateral musculature of the side of the body, I use this one as a good example, because if we look at the anatomy of a lung, rudimentary design, the lungs are somewhat triangular, right? They have an apex up at the top and they expand as they go down. But when you look at the lungs, if you were to cut your rib cage open and look at the lungs traverse the lateral side of your body more than they do the front side of your body. So if you're sitting here tracing your rib cage right now, if I put my finger here at my son's 10 years old, is one of his favorite terms, the xiphoid process, right? So at the bottom of your sternum, the little nodule, little bony mass that's at the bottom, it's called your xiphoid process, right? If you trace your lungs or your rib cage, you have to go down and out, right? It's not like it's level. Yeah. It's not like it's all equal. So when you visualize the lung tissue in your body, the lung tissue, the majority of the volume runs down along the outsides, the lateral sides of the rib cage. So back to my belly breathing concept, if you're a frontal breather and you think you're accessing the dynamic tissue stretching that you need to create more oxygen efficiency in the delivery into the blood, well, maybe you should step back and take a picture of Gray's Anatomy book again and look at the shape of your lung tissue. Where does that lung tissue need to be stretched? Into the voluminous area of the tissue itself. So if you distend your belly, is there a lung tissue down there where you're distending your belly in the central portion of your abdominal area? No, there's not. It's majoritively, that's why your ribs are shaped the way they are. They go lower down the sides of your body than in the front of your body. And the tissue, the beautiful genetics of the powers that be built us this way. So the tissue of the lungs go down towards that lower lateral aspect of the shape of the cage. So in theory, you want to be able to stretch the lateral musculature of your body, but you also, of course, want to stretch the frontal plane and also the backside musculature, forward bend, back bend, side bending, right? If you could think of those planes, you're starting to open up that 360 or quadrant view of the rib cage. And therefore, you're finally accessing, and you have to think about the dynamic structure of breath work as if you're a physicist. Where is the volume capacity? How do you stretch the balloon to open up that capacity? That's how you have to think about it. So lower abdominal area doesn't do much to stretch the tissue of your lungs. So you have to start to align your method, your consciousness, your awareness, and your muscularity to expand the balloon where there is balloon at the end of the day. So I personally love lateral stretching, and I love backward bending to open up the erector muscles of the abdomen. Yeah. And then back to breathing gymnastics with free divers, then you get to the point where, and I won't disrobe myself in front of your audience, but you get to the point where if you could see my ribs down here, like, you know, I could shove my hands up underneath my ribs, like really deep, because two things. A, I've been stretching those muscles for a very long time. And B, I've overcome the fear, the sympathetic reaction, because your mind does not like stuff going up under there. It does not like that.
No.
I've allowed myself to become comfortable with that flexibility and digging into those spaces. And to be fair, I have released tears of joy, tears of pain, tears of craziness, discovering those areas, but I broke them open. I've opened up those spaces over time. So I don't expect anybody in your audience to do crazy things like me and dig your hands up under your ribs, but I show that just as an example of how much space is available if you're willing to explore those spaces.
Oh, wow. I've seen a few people play about getting under there. I can't do it, but it's so that comes with practice, does it? And there's some education out there, some tips and tricks and techniques how to, because you can massage absolutely. Your diaphragm, can't you? Do you massaging? Yeah,
of course. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, in the depths of my yoga practice, when I'm 52 years old right now, in my mid to late 20s, when I was really rubbery and I could do a lot of things that I still have pictures. I can't do it now, but, you know, put my leg behind my head and do all that stuff. Wow. I was able to really dig in, and I was raw vegan back then too. So my blood, you know, the alkalinity in my blood, all that stuff, I was hyper flexible back then. Right. And that's when I was taught all those tricks about how to massage the organs and how to get into the rib cage. And back then it was about becoming enlightened and about opening up the chakras and all those things. But in reality, the physiology that I was moving around and the willingness to allow those muscles to be penetrated, that's where you start to unwind years and genetic eons of protection. So you can allow those spaces to open up. Because remember, your brain is a wonderfully brilliant, dumb instrument. At the end of the day, it doesn't want you to die and it doesn't want you to be hurt. So it tends to restrict access to those areas because it doesn't like it, because it doesn't understand it. But as human beings with potential, the neuroplasticity that we have available to us allows those to become habits and to become allowances if we do it consistently. Mm-hmm. So the goal is to just practice those things consistently. And I'm not special by any means. I'm just a crazy guy who does the same things all the time. And my body adapts to them at the end of the day. So everybody has access to it if they want to go down that path.
Yeah, you've inspired me, I'll tell you what. So here's one for you now. This is a very, for me anyway, hopefully for the audience, very interesting. I want to know where you sit when it comes to the old, not mouth versus nose, but maybe a little bit more deeper than that. So you're working with athletes, pro athletes, and you're doing a lot of stuff around, obviously, the muscles and the diaphragm and getting everything working down there. And then there's not necessarily another school of thought, but there's the other area, which is CO2 tolerance and air hunger and people that are mouth breathers. And actually, you know, there are a lot of athletes out there that actually maybe don't have very good bolt scores, you know, where they can hold their breath and they get that first impulse to breathe and they can raise that with it, the CO2 tolerance. So I'd love to know a bit about, do you do much around getting them to be nose breathers as well? Or do you think, or do you, I know this question's gone on a little bit, do you sit more with it being actually let's get the mechanics right first, then we'll worry about the biochemistry later? Where do you sit in all of that kind of discussion?
Yeah. So first and foremost, let me put my AeroFit hat on for a moment, because I get this question 100 times a day, especially with, you know, Patrick and James doing great work. I know their books. I agree with everything they say. So from a personal perspective, I'm a nose breather. Unless I'm talking or eating, you know, kind of thing, I'm using my nose all day long. So AeroFit gets the question, well, you guys are against nose breathing because you made a widget for your mouth. So the answer to that specifically is, this is a smaller pipe than this at the end of the day. And if I'm going to build musculature, it's back to the efficiency. Do I have the volume exchange capacity with my nose that I have with my mouth? No, I don't. It's a smaller pipe from a physics perspective. So if I choose to create a widget, besides the fact that it would be really hard to put a widget that you drive up your nose to breathe in and out with resistance, you have more volume capacity to exchange air. So it's more efficient to build the muscle in the body with your mouth. And from an RMT perspective, it's rare that I've ever seen, and nor do I really ever prescribe to people to use a device like this for more than 10 or 12 minutes a day. This is not a half hour, hour session. So from a dogmatic perspective, I always joke and say, look, breathe in and out of your nose 23 hours and 50 minutes a day, train 10 minutes a day. I don't think you're going to die because you're breathing through your mouth for 10 minutes. And then we also have to understand, like Dan Brulé would say in his world, you know, you breathe through your mouth more than you think because you talk all day long too. So relax a little bit about the nose. That being said, I absolutely advocate nose breathing for its benefits that you've stated on other conversations, right? So I won't restate those, but I agree with everything. I know oxygen advantage. I do bolt testing. I do high altitude simulated training with a lot of my clients. So I'm very aware of those things, but I typically work from a gross to subtle perspective when I coach people. And in the beginning, I think for the biochemical advantages of nose breathing from an explanation or an education perspective, to me, they come slightly after learning the mechanics of breathing, right? I'm not going to run into a room and say Bohr effect and talk about that. I have to tell them what their diaphragm is first and what the mechanics are. I got to get them moving before they can talk more subtle things.
Yes.
And I don't believe Patrick would necessarily disagree with me on that. We're all going in the same direction, but if I can't get people to functionally understand the anatomy of what's bringing breath in and out of the body, I think there's a level of awareness or foundational awareness that it has to be built before they get into the more nuanced areas of breathing, if you will. But I think we are all working together, and I am 100% advocate. And with my athletes, I absolutely talk to them about switching over to nose breathing. And I'll take competitive cyclists as an example, like someone like Chris Froome, who I talk to and train with this. If you know who Chris is, you know, won the Tour four times. Okay. So Chris Froome is one of the legends of cycling, won the Tour de France four times. When I was speaking with him about this, he's a tech savvy, data-driven athlete, like most cyclists are. So I believe they align really well with Patrick or Oxygen Advantage, because that's protocol driven. And it's a little bit more science than it is art in a lot of ways. I hope that's okay to say, at least that's how I think about it. He's one of the most aerobically efficient animals on the planet in terms of human beings, but he wasn't breathing through his nose. He was breathing through his mouth, and his vital capacity was not that big for someone you would consider to have an enormous engine, if you want to call respiration an engine. And so, yeah, I walked him through the basics of here's the mechanics, here's why you would breathe through your nose. If you're a diesel engine rather than a turbo engine, you want to go slow and build up over time. So I borrow from Patrick and James all the time, because it's a brilliant thing that they're spreading around the world. And if you are open-minded and not dogmatic about nose breathing, and you start to utilize some other tools, I believe you'll become a more well-rounded breath practitioner. And I'll always go down the path of there's a right time and a right place to do styles of breathing. Because if you're at full max capacity, true nose breathing is really hard. Like if you're sprinting up Mont Ventoux, you know, and you're 7,000 meters above sea level and you're sprinting, your mouth's going to open up and your engine's going to demand at some point that you get it all in. Now, you're not doing that 90% of the day, but there's going to be times where you just need volume access. And at those moments, you want adrenaline to come into the body. You want increased capacities. So you want to turn the sympathetic engine on. Now, 95% of people walking around the planet don't require that. Chris Froome might require that in other people. So when it comes to general population, nose breathe all the time. When you need to turn on the turbos and you need to kick the sympathetic on to get the adrenaline in the blood to win a sprint, you might want to open your mouth once in a while and get the engine going. So I like to be cautious with how I explain that, because I don't want to make any enemies, but I also want to hold my own and say there's a right time and a right place. But the majority of the time, nose breathing is the right way, you know, 99% of the time almost, Mike. That's my perspective.
Yeah, it's probably the most asked question I get on the channel. I've seen it hundreds, if not thousands of times. Or there'll be an exercise on there where it's used in the mouth, or there'll be somebody talking. And I think it's probably one of the most misunderstood parts about breath work. And as we said before we hit record, you know, about it being non-dogmatic. I really do like Dan Brulé, who I've got an interview of people interested in checking him out, whose nickname is the Bruce Lee of breath work. Really like that, because before I even knew of him, I was thinking, oh, I really want an MMA approach to breath work, because I feel like you shouldn't just go down one camp. And again, when it comes to mouth versus nose, I say you don't sit at home doing bicep curls all day, do you? You just go down the gym and do it for a few minutes. And that's how it is with some of these exercises. But no, I think you gave a really good explanation there. I'm keen to get your thoughts, because this is something I'm personally suffering with, and it's related to the gut area. Gut sucking. I don't know if you use a different term for that, but what's happened with me, and I'm not the only person, I'm sure, as when I was younger, I became very conscious of having a bit of a belly, and so I'd suck it in.
Okay.
And then that has stayed tense now for 25 years. and so I'm consciously aware of it. I try to do exercises to relax the belly and think about breathing out and all that good stuff. But every now and again, I'll just bring attention, go, oh, bloody hell, you sneaky little belly. You've gone back into being tense again. So I don't know if you've got any experience or any ideas of how we can kind of maybe start to break those patterns a little bit.
So I'm a big fan of quantum mechanics and quantum physiology. So of course I Bruce Lipton, Joe Dispenza, guys like that who maybe you're aware of. I like their explanation of how that system, sense of system works, right? Because at the end of the day, we're all human. We all share common denominators. You and I breathe. I know we have that in common. The moment we meet, I have that in common with everybody on the planet. And the other things we share in common are the fact that habits are built over time that we do and don't have control of. And we're manipulated when we're young to think certain ways without even knowing that that's being developed, right? And holding your belly in as a pattern, if it's been going on for 25 years, there's a lot of obvious reason that's happening. There might be some unconscious or subconscious reasons why that's happening. At the end of the day, when it comes to rewiring, or as Huberman, if you know Andrew, you listen to Andrew Huberman and Huberman Lab, talk about habits and outcomes of thought processes. I think it's the ability to understand yourself, A, as an energetic human being, B, as someone who has been wired, not permanently, to act in certain ways. And that through consistent exposure and through consistent awareness has the ability to unwind those. But the key to it all, the magic or the special sauce really is an absolute willingness to love thyself as thy are, right? And allow yourself to operate as a human being, not as a modified human being based on social media perspectives or the front of a magazine perspective. And nowhere in the annals, you brought up the hunter-gatherer a long time ago. No way did a hunter-gatherer sit around sucking his stomach in all day long, right? He didn't care. He just wanted the next meal, kind of thing. We've been taught a lot of wrong things in terms of efficiencies. So I would, the way I explain that, if you were to ask me in one of my courses, I would say, all you're describing to me is an inefficient use of those muscles at the end of the day. Do you want to be inefficient as a human being? Mm-hmm. If you do, continue that pattern. If you want to optimize the way you operate from an anatomy and physiology, which is gross to subtle, all the way up the chain at the top of the pyramid, which is the spiritual, you have to be willing to allow your body to be optimized for efficiency. Tensing muscle when they're not required to be used for standing up or walking is useless. It's a useless thought. So is that, evolution of your mental willingness, to be comfortable with who you really are? Yes. And we don't know each other well, Mike, but arguably there's psychosomatic issues, belief structures that you hold, some deeply rooted, some surface rooted, that you have to work consciously to become aware of, to unwind. And, but more importantly, like Dan Berlay's not going to sit around holding the stomach in. It'll be the way it should be because he's relaxed. Mm-hmm. And so in my world, there's a lot of talk about the term instant relaxation. How do you instantly relax everything? Not just some things, and you still hold on to the ones you want. And in the world of free diving, that's a big concept because you can't afford to tense things and use oxygen when you're 30 meters underwater, hoping to get back up to the surface. So in my perspective, in the back of my mind, all these things that I've been brought up and been working on for 35 years, it all comes back to your willingness to be efficient as an animal, right? And with us, with human beings, we have conscious thought. We have the ability to choose these things. And unfortunately, a lot of times we just simply don't want to listen to what's best for us. We want to appear the way the world wants us to appear. So I won't dig much deeper than that, but I think at the end of the day, the secret sauce is the willingness. And you know what? If you don't like the shape of your belly, I sometimes was heavy. I gain weight and lose weight too. I don't necessarily like the shape of my belly sometimes. I'm pretty cool with it at the end of the day. What do I do if I don't like it, or if I'm building up too much, fat, cellular fat in my body? What do? I change my diet and I make conscious decisions to eradicate that. Mm-hmm. So I feel good about myself, because there's something to be said about feeling good about yourself in the mirror and liking what you see, as long as you don't take it to the extremes. I think Joe Dispenza does a really great job, and Bruce Lipton, of explaining those, you know, real quantum aspects of how the mind can wreak havoc on how we hold ourselves and think about ourselves. So anybody who's interested in that, I would go down and listen to one, like listen to Joe's book, Supernatural, or one of those great books, and start to open your mind to the quantum field of living and dig into how your brain plays really terrible games on you for your entire life. And have some courage to expose those and dig into those areas so you can release that tension that's inside of you, Mike, because it's holding you, it's an inhibitor at the end of the day.
Yeah, I was about 10 or 15 kilos heavier at my heaviest, maybe even a bit more. So, and I think I've managed to shed a lot of that weight, but something's like residually left over. And I think I'll check a bit of old Joe, because I've never gone too far down the Joe rabbit hole. I've heard bits of clips and stuff, but it's something that I've been meaning to get stuck into. So I'll have a look at that. Thank you.
It's good. If you have time, it's good to plug into that stuff, because in reality, when you talk about, and I won't get into this with you, but when you talk about unified theory and you talk about, you know, the energy of who we are and the energy of the planet, you know, atomically, an atom is 99.9% space, right? At the end of the day. And when you start to extrapolate that into bigger conscious thoughts, and all we are is electrical energy, and we're a lot of space, and we're sending information to ourselves and receiving information all the time that are creating cellular structure at the end of the day. And it's all vibrational mechanism. It's all vibrational energy at the end of the day. And you're the architect of your archetype at the end of the day. You have the choice to be happy with what you have or not be happy with what you have. And if you're not happy with what you have, or you're conscious about it, you're making your endocrine system dump out hormones that you probably don't want in your body. So there's this ripple effect, you know, when it comes to a belief structure about what chemicals are racing around your body because your mind's interpreting things a certain way. And you know what? I know you can control it if you're willing to explore it. You just have to have the courage and the time to explore it. But more people should dig into that space and recognize how we create, you know, just these really terrible patterns inside of ourselves. But we say, oh, that's how we are. And we write it off.
Yeah,
we just write it off. That's a bunch of BS at the end of the day, you know?
No, okay. Thank you. Yeah. I think you've given me a little gift there to go and explore that. So you mentioned cellular, and I'm keen to know when people are doing, if we jump back into the respiratory muscle stuff, is there anything going on at a cellular level that starts to change? I'm always keen to know a bit about that. So you've got people using that device and they're sucking in and going out, the diaphragm's changing. Is it doing anything else that we should be aware of, that any benefits being created?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I have to be careful about how I articulate it whenever I answer this question, because, the back to Patrick and the Oxygen Advantage perspective, like the Buteyko, you know, world of breathing and so forth. Oxygen delivery is really important. And arguably the way to deliver oxygen is to bear a little bit more CO2. So it releases from hemoglobin to get into the cell. In my world, I do believe that as you become more relaxed with volume, which benefits nose breathers, by the way, having more efficient muscles and more flexibility makes it easier for you to draw breath in. So it's just simply less effort to breathe in and out. Yeah. So that actually makes nose breathing a lot easier. So that's a tie back to that. Maintaining your 96, 97% O2, your SpO2 in your blood is not that difficult for most people who are alive, right? But the complications come when breathing is stressful or the effort is hard. And stressful and hard are terms that get linked right away to adrenaline or cortisol or sympathetic reaction in the body. And they've shown in several academic studies, which is really interesting. And I'll use athletics as an analogy for the moment. This metabo reflex that is designed inside of our body as a failover system that the sympathetic nervous system and the primal brain holds to be able to protect us. So the sympathetic body has nerve endings throughout our entire body. It's scanning all the time. In the respiratory area of the body, those nerve endings, they're a little bit more naked, a little bit more raw. So they're more sensitive. And there's a reason for that. It's because it's around the primal area of survival, the ability to take breath in and out and near our heart. So when you're working and you're creating lactic or metabolites, or lactate or lactic acid, whichever you want to call it, we'll generically call those all the same thing for the moment, through muscular work. And that muscular work is being created by the combination of O2 and glucose in the mitochondria, right? So you have to pair those two things together. So to backtrack just a quick, I do have a plan around this conversation, so bear with me. When you're pulling in breath and you're under duress or you need more breath, you need access to breath. And so expanding and building more capacity is an important component of the equation. You never want to run out of that molecule of fuel, O2, to be able to combine with glucose to create energy in the Krebs cycle or the glycolysis, or, you know, whatever you want. There's a bunch of names to call it, right? But we'll call it Krebs cycle for the moment. As you do that, and as you're active, you develop lactic acid. And with respiratory muscular training, there's this abolishment or this inhibition to the mind's willingness to draw back or vasoconstrict oxygen blood delivery to the locomotors, the locomotor muscles like the arms and the legs. Right. And so when you train the respiratory musculature and you train the respiratory system to become strong and efficient, that metabol reflex, the sympathetic response to reacting to thresholds of intensity of work, is managed better. The brain does not turn it on as quick. And they say in my world that the metabol reflex is the straw that broke the camel's back, kind of thing. So as lactate builds up, as lactate threshold is reached or getting close to, the sympathetic mind is keeping an eye on that, and it's going to choose to slow you down. That's what happens when you reach your lactate threshold. If you want to have a larger delta or time variant to reach those thresholds, what do you do? You train the body to become more efficient in the biochemical receptive nature of the sympathetic nervous system. And if this system, the respiratory system, is efficient, that call for sympathetic reaction to shut you down and to allow or pull blood back from the extremities back to core, that call doesn't happen as soon anymore. So you're able to continue to keep moving or keep being active as an athlete for a longer period of time. And I find that a really interesting thing. And it's a complex, ancillary, compounded conversation. There's a lot of stuff going on, but the oxygen delivery and the resulting metabolites and respiratory byproducts of breathing are fascinating to me. And my goal ultimately in the world of RMT is to understand how I can help people create efficiencies around how oxygen is utilized, how we manage the metabolites that are created at the cellular level from respiration, and how we can elongate or push out the sympathetic shutdown, if you will, from over-intensified work, which we all have a maximum capacity. At a certain point of work, the mind is going to say, no more, you're done. I'm going to shut the locomotor muscles down. I'm going to vasoconstrict or shrink the dilation of arteries and veins, pull everything back to core, because my job is to keep you alive. It's not to care how long you work, right? So that's that wonderful implement. We have a brain that makes really primal decisions on our behalf in extreme ways. So that beautiful protective nature that we have a way of tuning it, extending it, modifying it, if we utilize tools like an RMT device. So I think it's really fascinating. There's not enough study done on it, to be fair, because there's a lot of ancillary mechanism, endocrine compounds. Nobody really understands the soup. Maybe Andrew Huberman understands it better than everybody that I hear these days. I think he's really articulate in how he explains it. But it's still a field that has so much academic study to be done on it. So we have to theorize a little bit before we can actually, you know, attain the academic articles that we have to say it's a fact. Yeah. But there's this wonderful primordial soup that's happening in the body. And I think if you take Patrick and James and their nose breathing and their Bohr effect and the delivery of O2, you add a little bit of RMT, you add a little bit of Huberman, you add a little bit of all these, you know, these beautiful schools. At some point, someone's going to be able to piece all those together and explain the unified theory, if you will, about how all these things work together. But in my little world of RMT, I know I can affect lactate concentration. I can affect the ability for the body to react sympathetically to work. And I know from academic study that people have done academic studies where they simply have proven that there's a better feeling to work when you train with the respiratory muscle devices. And feelings create emotions, which create biochemical compounds. And if we can control biochemical compound delivery by controlling the, go backwards on the ladder and get back to stress and the feelings that we have, if we could feel better about what we're doing physically because of this device, and therefore down the pathways control the chemical compounds that are being put out into our body, we're one step closer to controlling the efficiencies and outcomes that we face that we think we don't have control of. So I think in my world, the exciting world is how far, you know, can we go in both directions, and we can understand the communication, the two-way communication paths on that emotion to feeling to chemical compound. I argue this helps you in that path. It's one of the lanes. It's one of the swim lanes, if you will, in the pool for that chain or that ladder of communication. So if you want to become efficient, this is one of the efficiency tools that you should use. Yeah. If you want to become a better breather and you want to satisfy working while relaxing, which ultimately is my quest. I want to be able to work as hard as I can while I'm relaxed. That's the goal. And that's how you nose breathe better as well. If you learn to relax during your hardest work, you could still nose breathe because you're not panicking, right? Mm-hmm. We're avoiding that sympathetic firing. So this helps with that a lot. Yes. It takes some of that panic away, that breathless, oh my God, I'm running out of breath. What am I going to do? And there goes the negative compounding effect. And the adrenaline pumps out, respiration goes up, heart rate goes up, O2 delivery goes up, glucose utilization goes up. And before you know it, you're done. And it was all because of a thought. And we can circumvent those thoughts with something like this. And that's pretty powerful at the end of the day, I think. It's exciting.
That is exciting. How much of breath hold is psychological, do you think?
Oh, the majority of it.
Really?
Yeah, of course. I'll give you an example. So I won't name his name, but he lives in town here. I'm benefiting from where I live geographically. I live about 7 kilometers down the road from the Navy UDT SEAL Museum. So in Fort Pierce, Florida, right down the road, it was when Navy SEALs were born in the 1950s and 60s, their first training center was right down the road from me. And so now a lot of retired Navy SEALs live down the road from me. So young kids who want to become Navy SEALs come here, they get mentored, they get told what life is like, you know, what you're getting yourself into. And a bunch of them have found their way to my local studio where they come into my studio and I'm generically 52 and out of shape compared to a Navy SEAL candidate. Let's leave it at that, right? There's no way they could out burpee me any day of the week. But they come into my studio or to my room where I work with them. And one of the first things I do is say, okay, lie down on the floor. I'm not going to teach you anything. Hold your breath as long as you can. And I sit there with my clock. And by the time they're done holding their breath, I know more about them than they care to think I know, because I could see their panic reactions. I could see their fears. I could see how they hold themselves. I see how their emotions can be kept in check or not. And so, for example, this friend of mine who's, again, I won't name him, but he lives locally. He came in and he was in incredible shape. And he was destined to become a SEAL. I'll leave it at that for now. He came in and the first time he held his breath, for about a minute and 15 seconds. Now, of course, I knew he had the capacity to hold his breath for at least double that the moment he came in.
Yeah.
But a lot of things were holding him back. Fear, things that happened to him when he was young from his mom and his dad that came out later in some of our breath work. And 3 hours after my first session with him, I had him holding his breath for 3 minutes and 20 seconds. So what changed over those 3 hours? He didn't become fitter, right? He learned to relax. He learned about the biophysiological reactions that you have when you hold your breath and what those mean. And he became confident about being able to manage what previously was unknown sources of panic. Mm. So I believe holding breath is a window into the soul of a human being, because as you learn to understand the biophysiology, the rest of it all is how calm can you stay in the midst of stress that is building up inside of you. So why can a free diver who is generically in shape as an Olympic marathon runner hold their breath 5 times longer? Mm. Because they've learned the mental acuity and the ability to relax under predetermined stressful environments, your primal brain's willingness to tell you to stop and breathe because it doesn't like the situation. So CO2 tolerance, you could learn CO2 tolerance. Your mind can learn to become relaxed at higher levels of CO2 levels in your blood from consistency and training. But when you first experience a diaphragm, like an intercostal contraction or flux, you know, movement of your diaphragm, which is a signal. I like to talk people through the signals of breath holding, right? Like for me, I'll hold my breath that minute, at 2 minutes and 20 seconds, I'll start to salivate and I'll swallow. That's step one. That's my brain saying, here's my first try to get you to breathe again, Sean. Yeah, I don't like what you're doing. I'm going to flood your mouth with a little bit of spit and I'm going to make you swallow. Maybe that'll make you open your mouth and you'll take a breath. And I say, no, thanks. I know that trick. I'll wait for the next one. The next one is my diaphragm starts to flutter. I start to have contractions. And in the beginning, those contractions feel really awkward. You don't like them. They're uncomfortable. And now I meet them with a smile because I know it's just another way my mind, it's step two. My mind's going to now try a little harder to get me to breathe. And there's these steps that you learn of typical reactions that the biophysiological, chemical, mental being that we are is simply trying to stop you from doing what you're doing because it doesn't like it. And you have to have the willpower and confidence to keep going. And so I think you could teach people these things. And I have 70, 80-year-olds, 6-year-olds, 50-year-olds come in and they out-breath hold 20-year-olds who are in shape because they're more relaxed and willing to be open-minded than opinionated type A Navy SEALs, right, at the end of the day. All due respect to Navy SEALs and anybody who's in special ops in that level of stress. Why can they not do it? Because it's stress and how they handle stress. And being a Navy SEAL, you need to be able to relax like that. Otherwise, you make irrational decisions. You can make bad decisions. You could shoot your friend instead of the enemy. All these things. So at those highest levels of conversation around stress and reactions and rational thought, I think we all could benefit from learning how we react to breath holding, because breath, if I put a pillow over your mouth right now, Mike, and I keep you on the floor, eventually your MMA skills will come out and you'll punch me or kick me and throw me off of you because you don't want to die. How long can you be comfortable with me holding that pillow over your face? It's a sign of how you process stress and how you can relax. So free diving is a beautiful expression of that, because when you're in the holding your breath out in the open, when breath is always accessible just by opening up your mouth or nose and breathing, that's easy. How do you control it when you're underwater and you don't have access to O2? Those are the moments where I think if you expose yourself to those opportunities, you have to come to terms with how you deal with that stress. And I think that makes us all better human beings and happier human beings, because I've learned to hold my breath in water and I have no choice. I have to hold it if I'm underwater. So if I panic or send myself down the chemical compound route of increasing my respiration and putting adrenaline in, I'm in more trouble. So under those stressful situations, I need to learn to smile and relax at those situations so I don't burn up the fuel I need. And if you take that as a philosophy and you apply it to everything else in life, well, dying from losing your breath is pretty dramatic. If I'm not about to die, life's pretty good, right? That's the lesson I take away from it. So should I get stressed in general if I'm not at the end of my breath about to die? No. And I've learned that through exploring breath holding. So I think it's a beautiful art form.
You've just got me like re-excited about breath holds again, because I've trained under Patrick and I've trained people, you know, to do different high altitude training, simulation training, all these different things. But for me, the onset of panic comes on so quickly. I get to about 40, 45 seconds with no air in the lungs. And there's no saliva or diaphragm fluttering. It's just the panic's just there for me. So that's why
you don't even get there yet, right? Yeah,
you don't even get there because right. The psychological fear, whatever that uncomfortableness of the air hunger feels so strong for me. Even though I know I've got loads of oxygen, relax. You can go for minutes and minutes. You're not going to die. It's that, and then all that kind of comes in. So I need to go and climb.
An interesting side topic of all of this too, from the world, the beautiful world of freediving. So shout out to all my freediving friends, because it's they're the ones, I think, that the lab rats of the world when it comes to breathing. Like, they're the ones who push the limits of breathing at the end of the day. I feel it's such a unknown sport and a misunderstood sport, if you will, and it's an art at the same time. You know, delta temperature changes, for example. So if I'm sunning myself and then I put my face into cooler water and my trigeminal nerve is stimulated by the temperature variant, that trigeminal stimulation hastens bradycardia, hastens the slowing of my heart, allows me to vasoconstrict faster and quiet my body down and manipulate the pull of blood back to core instead of feeding my limbs and so forth. So there's all these interesting physiological techniques and explanations that free diving has exposed, the mammalian dive response, if you've ever heard of that, right? There, we have these tools at our disposal. Like, I have friends who have a ice bowl of water near them. They duck their face in it when they want to calm down because it helps stimulate the relaxation of the circulatory system. So you'll see free divers and some of my friends, you know, training people to have better breath holds by taking their face from warm environment to cold environment, because that stimulates the trigeminal nerve. And so when you start to unlock, when you start to unlock and you get all these keys to all these different locks, you start to play with them, you start to use them in tandem and in combination. And I believe in the yogic world, right? The true yogi remembers every breath they ever took. Imagine that. That's a pretty complicated thing to think. And then a real yogi lives not only in between their breaths, but in between the beats of their heart. Mm. When you start to drill into that as a concept and you think about quantum time and you're utilizing these tools you learn from freediving, for example, ultimately you want to quiet your mind and your body down to the point where you don't even notice that you're not breathing anymore. It becomes your natural state. And that's where you find that blissful flow environment where time expands and contracts. It's five. What do you mean 5 minutes just happened? It felt like 10 seconds. Mm-hmm. And you start to find that space where those panics, they don't even exist anymore, because you are so at ease and you understand intellectually what stress is that you can choose to avoid it and eradicate it and live in this wonderful sense of being where you're flowing and nothing else matters. So you're able to be the absolute most efficient person you could be in that moment. And to me, that's the true search. And none of us can be there every day, all day, because we work and do things. But the goal is to be able to access that space, that flow space, as fast as you can, whenever you want it. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, that's the goal. And I think breath holding is a tool that helps you learn how to, you know, control those mechanisms so you can get there quicker.
I love it. You, like I said, I'm really enthusiastic now to go and play with breath holds again. Thank you.
Yeah, go do it. It's awesome.
Thank you. No, I will. We've just done 90 minutes. I don't know how that's gone on. Is there anything that we haven't covered that you wanted to talk about?
Oh my goodness, 90 minutes. I didn't even look at the clock. Like, I told you I could talk a lot. I get excited about this stuff. I think it's an infinite, like you said earlier, we're just scratching the surface. I do want to add in here, you can leave it in or cut it out, but a shout out to all the breath teachers out in the world who are helping the world become more conscious. None of us are competing for space, you know, if we're doing this the right way. We're all trying to help people connect with breathing. And I think this, you know, respiratory muscular training, the work I do at AeroFit 9 to 5, if you will, it's one avenue of breath training and conceptual thought processes that help. It might, you know, the teacher appears when the student is ready kind of thing. You know, hot yoga was right for me when I needed to heal myself. Some person might find Dan Brulé and connect with him today. Some person might connect with RMT today. Ultimately, the goal is, and what you're helping us all do, is share these different schools of breath so the student can find the right teacher when they decide to enter into the space and begin their journey of educating themselves, right? And so in the perfect world, when I taught yoga, was that as soon as you get used to me as your teacher and you like me as your teacher, it's time to leave. Go find another teacher. Right. Go keep searching. You don't want to get dogmatic and stuck. Right. You always want to free your mind and be flexible so you can learn and discover. And if you want to be monastic about things, I'm cool with that too. But right, it's like, you know, the things that Dan and Patrick and James and Wim and all these guys can offer, it's a gateway into knowledge and becoming conscious about what we do. And, you know, I'd like to play my little part in that world, if I could. And I love the enthusiasm that is built around this. And I think the world's changing right now. COVID has helped people become more aware of breathing too. So yes. I'm taking the positive note on that. Everybody's aware of their respiratory capacities now. And if they did things like train with their respiratory muscles prior to getting COVID, I can't make a claim. I can't do that. But theoretically, if you go into COVID with stronger, more efficient muscles, there's a chance you might do better when you have it. I won't claim anything. And for the people that I train after COVID, after they get past symptoms and they utilize a device like this to build back up their capacities, I'm noticing those people who do this get back up to capacity faster. And they don't seem to be suffering as long afterwards because they're making hypertrophy happen. They're not allowing atrophy to stay intact. So that's a really cool thought process right now with people suffering from COVID. What could you do to help yourself with any respiratory? If you have pneumonia, you need to expel mucus. So you don't want weak musculature. You want to be able to expel efficiently. That leads to the need for strength in respiratory muscle. So there's a whole world of thought that you could start to think about. If you go down the rabbit hole a little bit, it starts to become hard to negate that respiratory strength and flexibility. You can't really say it's a bad thing. It's typically a good thing, no matter what area you're in, even if you're a nose breather, it's good all around. I think for those people who are listening to this and paying attention, if you have more questions, certainly reach back out, you know, to Mike or whatever. That would be my suggestion, or find me or AeroFit or a company that does this type of thing. But, you know, it's hard for me to find a negative with respiratory muscular training. The only thing I would tell people is don't overdo when it comes to respiratory muscular training. So the one last thought I would say is more is not better. It's not a no pain, no gain environment. If the protocol recommends 10 minutes a day, 20 minutes is not better. And that gets back to habit formation again. When type A's take a respiratory muscular training device and the protocol says start at the easiest setting, what do? They ramp it up to the hardest setting and they multiply the amount of time by 3 and they think they're doing themselves better. But in our world, Mike, what they're really doing is making it harder to change their predetermined habits. And I like to use the term loosely that RMT done right is sneaking, if you're doing it well, you're sneaking up on your nervous system, allowing those habits to change, rather than trying to force change to happen, because your mind doesn't like forceful change. It needs to be coaxed into changing. So slow consistency with RMT is better than hard driven more in the beginning, because otherwise you're never going to change those embedded patterns. So like all other breath work, if you engage every day and approach it slowly and allow your body to build into that new pattern, your body won't defend and try to keep the old pattern as much. So same thing applies here, I believe.
Yeah, brilliant.
Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And I'm very type A, so that's my initial reaction. Hardest settings, go as long as you can. So I'm glad you shared that. Thank you. That was a message I needed to hear as well. Sean, it's been an absolute pleasure, my friend. Thank you so much for your time. Where can people go next if they want to learn more? Where's the best resource?
Sure. I think the best place to start is you go to AeroFit's website. It's www.aerofit.com. And that's, AeroFit.com. AeroFit, just quickly, I haven't talked about the company really, but you know, the company's based in Copenhagen. For anybody who's interested, you could read about the history of the company on the website. But the long story short is, when this was a rudimentary piece of plastic device before AeroFit got its hands on it, it was created by a Danish medical company called Anbu. And they had originally designed this to specifically help asthmatics and COPD patients. So the genetic history of this device, if you will, before it became seen as an athletic performance device, which we don't want to be stranglehold to that thought process. It helps on the therapeutic side as much as it helps on performance side. But the structural bones of this device was built to help with asthma and COPD. And Aerofit sells as many devices to people with those issues as it does to performance-seeking people. Even though the website looks like it's hyper-driven towards athletic performance, that just seems to be the most vocal group that we engage with. So hence the marketing representation that's on there. But there's a library of interesting academic study links on there. So some of our advisors to our company, you know, we link to those academic studies. So people who have the need or the will to read through, you know, tomes of respiratory science, you know, that information's there. And we're doing better at the company every day to build up the social media engagement side of it. So we have an active Facebook community. It's not advertising. It's where people who own or don't own an Aerofit device can come and ask questions to our staff. If our staff doesn't know it, those questions usually land at my desk. So I'm very active in that community. So people can check us out on Facebook and join that community. You don't have to own an Aerofit device to join that community. And you can learn a lot from the people. We have a lot of elite level coaches and athletes who use our device. And sometimes they answer the questions better than I can because they're out there using it, you know, as much as me or more for very specific reasons. So dig into those spaces and become part of the conversation, basically. That would be great.
Fantastic. Sean, thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on the Breathcast. And people, please go and check out the links below. I've put it in the show notes so you can go to the Aerofit website and have a look. And we will see you all on the next Breathcast. Cheers, everyone. Cheers, Sean. Thank you.
Thanks, mate.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that Breathcast with Sean. He's a really interesting chap, isn't he? And such a variety of knowledge about breathing and wellness. If you're interested in picking up your very own Aerofit, I've been using my 9 for a while, really enjoy it. We do have an affiliate link down below, so there's a couple of quid, a couple of dollars that get kicked back to the podcast, and you get your very own Aerofit, so you can start playing with that straight away. If you enjoyed that Breathcast, then you might want to check out this breathing video or breathing exercise, or you might want to check out this podcast. I think it might be quite relevant to what you've just seen there. So click one of those and keep watching with us, and I'll speak to you on the next video. Cheers.